This is Fresh Air. In James Dickey's best-known novel, Deliverance, which he also adapted into a film, four suburban men take a canoe trip and find it's not the best way to relax. As if the wild rapids aren't enough, they're preyed on by demented backwoods men who rape them and then shoot them with bows and arrows. Dickey's new novel is also about being tested by the elements and preyed on by other men. To the White Sea is about an American tail gunner whose plane is shot down over Tokyo just before the firebombing of that city during World War II. He is alone in enemy territory. His instincts tell him to head north, to the wilderness, where it is too cold for most men to live and he can be alone. The novel is about how he survives against his enemies and the elements. I asked James Dickey why he's so interested in that theme.
I have always been attracted to that element in fiction when someone else wrote it. And I'm not equipped to write novels of the higher crusts of society like Henry James or Edith Wharton or someone like that, or Lewis Auchincloss. I couldn't do it. I don't have the knowledge of it. And above all, I don't have the interest in it. But something like this I have a great interest in, a survival situation. The American poet Alan Tate once told me, he said, Jim, I sometimes think of my poems as commentaries on those human situations from which there's no escape. I'm very sympathetic to that attitude, and that's what I try to comment on, too, in what I write.
Now, I think it was when you were flying missions during World War II that you first started to read poetry seriously.
Well, yes, I read a lot of things, and the prose things, novels and so on that I read had a certain quality that I liked. I could tell that I had rather read a writer named William Faulkner than one named James T. Farrell, who's a very prosaic and matter-of-fact and rather journalistic type of a writer. Then I sort of dimly recognized early on that there was some difference in kind between Faulkner and James T. Farrell. And I finally saw, after some time, that the quality that I wanted was more concentrated and better expressed in poetry than it was in prose fiction. So gradually I sort of gravitated over to poetry went with that more than I did any other kind of reading that I did.
Well, how did you end up reading more while you were flying missions during World War II?
Well, there's when you're overseas, you're in a squadron, if you're not actually flying in combat missions and so on, you have a good deal of time. We had a squadron library. There was sort of a miscellaneous assortment of your armed services editions and so on, and I read whatever was there and so on. And then when I got back from overseas in the early part of 1946, I had some money accumulated from being over there for a good while, and I went to New York and I just bought a lot of books and read them, you know, and everything just sort of built up from that.
Then you went back to college too, right?
Yeah, I started all over as a first-term freshman at Vanderbilt. I had been for a semester at Clemson where I didn't take any interest in books or intellectual pursuits, poetry, anything else. I was strictly an athlete. I was kind of an average college football player and not the best. I had my moments, but nothing, no superstar. But my main interest up to that time was sports. But the war changed everything, changed my values, and I came back and I didn't go back to Clemson to play ball. I didn't have to play football anymore for a college education. I had the GI Bill, so I just enrolled as a freshman at Vanderbilt, which had a good intellectual and artistic tradition. I wanted what Vanderbilt had. I had no interest in what Clemson had.
When you say the war changed your values, what are some of the values that changed that affected how you lived your life afterwards?
The beginnings of a lifelong interest in the imagination and its works. Everything came out of those years. And when I went to Vanderbilt, I concentrated on that and went on from there.
Well, Was it a different world, the world of literature?
Yes, indeed.
From the world of athletics that you were used
yes,
to?
Yes, it certainly was different and unendingly fascinating. The more I found out, the more I wanted to find out. And it goes on today, as they say in the awful jargon of our time, as we speak.
Well, I'm sure the people were different, too, than the people who you had been used to?
Yeah, but I like them, too. I mean, I like football players and coaches and athletes and so on very much still. But my interest in them is relatively limited, and my connection with them and my social, concordance with them is relatively slight. But the main people that I find a rapport with are the people who are in some way in the arts. It doesn't have to be literature or poetry. It can be in a drama, it can be in dance, music, and so on.
Did you find a way early on in your writing to write about the physical things that interested you?
No, I wrote about things that stuck in my mind. As far as the choice of subject matter was concerned, my only rule of thumb is that if something keeps recurring to me without any apparent reason for it to keep coming back to my mind, then I know it's a potential subject because I can't get rid of it. I know that I have to deal with it. I have to write about it in some way, whether right or wrong, good or bad.
My guest is James Dickey. His new novel is called To the White Sea. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. James Dickey is my guest. Now, you worked in advertising for a while before you started writing full-time. What kinds of accounts did you have?
I started with Coca-Cola. Then I had various others. I moved to another agency where we had Lay's potato chips. That was before the fusion that created Frito-Lay. I did some bank advertising, and the last agency I worked for handled a Delta Airlines account.
Did you write any of the jingles or slogans?
I did. I wrote a lot of them. Some were used locally, and some were used in other connections. I don't believe I'm at liberty to tell you which ones.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't think the company... I don't want the companies coming back at me. Or somebody else claiming they did it. I don't think that's important. Not anymore.
Did you make good money at it?
Well, more than I'd ever made before. But I was there 5.5 or 6 years, and I had a book of poems out, and another one that was coming out, and I was given a Guggenheim Fellowship. And after one splendid conversation with my wife, we packed everything and the two children into the Volkswagen bus and went to go and live and work in the south of Italy, down south of Naples, in a little fishing village.
So that's when you started writing full-time?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I had been writing a lot, though. I mean, I had, when I was in the ad business, I wrote in the evening and in the morning before I went to work. I wrote on the weekends, I wrote on vacations, and going to sales meetings and whenever I could. Somebody asked me why wasn't it rather difficult to write poetry and the concentration that poetry demands under those conditions. And I said, no, I can write anywhere. Anybody who learned to write poetry on a troop train can write anywhere.
Right. I think you're probably best known for your novel Deliverance, and you also wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation. What was the inspiration for that story?
Well, I usually start anything I write with an image, as I said earlier, one of these obsessional images. I was sort of taking a siesta in Italy in 1962, and I saw, it just came to me. I had no intention my train of thought, such as it was not, didn't have anything to do with this. But I just saw a man standing at the top of a cliff. I didn't know how he had gotten there, whether he came from the woods at the edge. Immediately they materialized woods in the picture. I didn't know whether he had just come out to the edge of the cliff and was looking around there, or whether maybe he had come up the cliff for some reason. What would be the reason? So gradually the story took hold of me, and in in a few minutes, I don't know how many, but I knew the whole story. I knew who the people were going to be. I knew where it was going to take place. I knew what was going to happen to them, pretty much, and so on. And I just made some notes and went back to sleep, and everything started working out of that beginning.
I think the scene that made the biggest impact in Deliverance, the movie, and probably in Deliverance, the novel, is the scene where one of the characters is raped.
Well, that's famous. I can't really say justly famous, but famous it is. Bobby is the boy, the salesman, is the one that is the victim. That scene isn't necessary to the novel because the reader is going to want to see something terrible happen to that man that perpetrated the rape. Billy McKinney, who played him, and I thought he did a wonderful job. I would not be averse to saying that he was the best thing in the movie, although I have great praise for everybody else in it, too. I remember when he came up on the set, and I said to him, Billy, Mr. McKinney, you have one function in this movie. That audience is going to have to hate you. He says, don't worry, Mr. Dickey, they're going to hate me. Have you ever seen anybody that you'd rather see get shot in the back with an arrow more than that guy? And so on. So he did very good. He did a good job on that. He was very convincing.
Do you think that part of what made the rape scene so shocking to audiences was the fact that it was one man raping another man?
Well, that's shocking enough. But the most shocking thing about it, and the thing that makes you so disgusted and even terrified about it, is the humiliation of the fat boy, you know, making him squeal like a pig and all that stuff. If you're going to assault somebody sexually, you don't have to do all that, you know. But the fact that he does it makes him singularly depraved and repulsive.
Do you think that this scene also, you know, played on people's fears of homosexuality?
That's not really what I had in mind at all. What I wanted to do was to have a scene which would bring into focus the most abiding and the deepest fear of people in our time and our century, which is the fear of being set upon by malicious strangers.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to happen off in the woods of North Georgia. It can happen on the streets of New York or any other city. To be assaulted by people who had just as soon kill you as look at you. In fact, some of them had rather. That's the fear of our time. And I wanted to use that motif and as a lead in to what happens in the rest of the story.
You know, I think that's a fear that most Americans live with, and you live with it in one way in a city and in a different way in the country.
Yeah, it's much worse in the city because there's so many more people. But it's bad enough at any time or any place.
Mm-hmm. What kind of home do you live in now, and how close to nature are you?
Well, I live on a lake surrounded by woods, and there's a lot of wildlife there. I mean, just in the yard. We have rabbits, we have snakes, we've got all kind of birds. There's even an otter that lives in my backyard and swims in the lake. We call him the creature. And then I have another home at Paulus Island, which is very naturey, and so on. And then I get out in the woods as much as I can and just walk around. Sometimes I take a bow and you know, just to have one with me. I like having a weapon and so on. And I love archery. I love to shoot arrows.
Do you hunt?
I did a lot. I used to hunt a lot, but I don't do that. I think I may have gone on the last hunt already, but I still like to be out in the woods with a bow and the broadhead arrows. That's something that appeals to me to do.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
James Dickey's new novel is To the White Sea. This is Fresh Air.